Hello, I am Pete Real, a high school English and Spanish teacher, an avid reader, and an aspiring writer. Thank you for listening to the Chills at Will podcast, in which we explore the visceral beauty of literature and its connection to our culture, our history, and ourselves. Welcome to episode 124 of the Chills at Will podcast. Pleasure today to be joined by Robin Peguero. A little bit about him. He's an Afro-Latino and the son of immigrants who graduated from Harvard College and Harvard Law School. He's written for the Miami Herald, the Harvard Crimson, and the Harvard Law Review, and he served as a press spokesman in the U.S. House and as a speechwriter in the U.S. Senate before becoming a lawyer. He is currently a U.S. House investigative counsel working on domestic terrorism. It is a pleasure to have you. How are you today?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you for having me.
Oh, man, such a pleasure, like I said. And so we just talking about before we started recording that you're like 3 days out and you are in D.C. right now. I wonder, you know, tell us a little bit about what's coming up this week and how it feels with like the debut novel coming out in 3 days.
Yeah, no, this has been a lifelong dream for me ever since I was a little kid. So it's sort of surreal that it's right here. It's finally come to fruition. This week, you know, there's going to be a virtual event with Poison Pen on Tuesday.
Okay.
And then an in-person event in Miami at Books and Books, which is a place I've purchased books before, sat yeah. there out in the patio and, you know, read some books there. So it's kind of, again, very surreal and able to be there as an author this time and not just as a customer. So I'm excited about this week.
What was it like? What was it like the first time you saw your name on the, you can see over my right shoulder here, the beautiful book cover, the whole deal. What did it feel like to see your name, big old letters, you know?
Yeah, it was, it sort of takes up a lot of space on the cover, which was not my choice, but it was an interesting aesthetic choice by the publishing company. But it was incredible, if only because also, you know, my name is not a very common name. And so I think it means something to my parents, to my dad. It's, you know, obviously his family name. To have a funny sounding name like mine sort of on a, you know, an American book cover, I think it's quite indicative of, you know, the American dream and how much opportunities we have in this country. And I feel very blessed and lucky to have seen that.
So cool. Going back a little bit, I know, I mean, I've in some of the interviews and in your acknowledgements and stuff, you talk about, you know, from age 8, age 10, you know, writing, always having the pen in your hand and having some great mentors and people who passed you along or, you know, inspired you as you went along. What was your relationship with language growing up? Did you grow up bilingual? Was it monolingual with some Spanish, you know, peppered in there? How would you describe that?
Yeah, no, I, you know, my parents emigrated to this country. My mom, when she was 24, my father, when he was 17, and they met in the U.S. Army and got married. So their first language is Spanish. I grew up hearing them speak Spanish to me as a kid. I'm native speaker of both English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, going to school and watching American TV, that is my predominant language, English is. You know, with how I converse with my folks, often it is in Spanish. And so I think that was nice to have that sort of, to be bilingual that young. And maybe it had something to do with how much of an interest I took to reading from a young age.
Now, did your parents come from Cuba or Dominican or?
Yeah, no, my dad's from the Dominican Republic. My mom is from Ecuador. So interesting mix. Yeah.
Right. What, growing up in Miami, is that right? Like a suburb of Miami or Miami proper? Or how would you describe it?
Yeah. So I lived up until I was 5 in New York. I was actually born in Providence, Rhode Island.
Oh, okay.
But we moved down to Miami when I was 5 and that's where I grew up. I was there through high school. In particular, it's a city called Hialeah. It's part of Miami-Dade County. But it's a very, you know, working class Cuban American town. So all of my best friends and most of my classmates were Cuban American. And it's a, you know, a place that's very entrenched in Hispanic culture, when you go into a store, you're greeted in Spanish first, and so rather than in English. So it was nice to have that sort of sense of home and culture and warmth growing up.
Right. Is there a big Ecuadorian population in Miami and Hialeah? Right.
No, not particularly. And my, I feel like a lot of my Dominican side of my family, a lot of them are in Providence, and I do think there's a good community there. But no, it's there's Cuban Americans, there's Colombian Americans, and Venezuelan Americans, mostly in terms of Hispanic population. Not so much representation for Dominicans or Ecuadorians.
Right. Now, Natalie Lima was a classmate, right?
Yes, she was. We went to high school together. Yeah.
Oh, very cool. Doing big things too from the same high school, man.
Yeah, no, she's great, and she's been very supportive. It's kind of nice. It's fortuitous that both of us are sort of trying, our paths, our authorial paths, sort of at similar times. But she's amazing and someone I look up to, and quite a good friend.
So cool. So, tell us about growing up and just loving to write. I mean, were you a reader then a writer? Was it concurrent? How, you know, what were you reading as well at that time?
Yeah, I feel like it was pretty concurrent. I was reading I feel like I was reading R.L. Stein and, you know, young adult stuff when I was a kid, some horror, some science fiction, things like that. I also would read whatever my sister was reading. So sometimes I was reading things that were probably for teenagers when I was far too young, because I've looked up to my sister all my life. And so whatever she was doing, I wanted to do. So I would just steal her books and read them. But at the same time is sort of when I decided, or I just got into writing, and it was always fiction. It was always the idea that I guess you could create something, you can have control over your life. Maybe, you know, childhood angst, you don't have a lot of control over your life, but when you write, you can sort of create a world and have it look exactly how you want it to look. And so I think that's what appealed to me. And since young age, it's an odd hobby, I think, but I'm just writing stories. It's always what interested me.
Do those stories still exist? Are they like in a closet somewhere? Like those early ones?
They might. I'm sure they're like in some spiral notebooks in my parents' garage or something. Okay. They're tucked away somewhere. I'm sure I could find them.
So remind me of your publishing companies. Is Grand Central?
That's right. So it's Hachette Books, but then the imprint is Grand Central. Yeah.
So you're sure they're not planning on releasing your earlier stuff?
Oh, I would hope not. I'd be mortified. Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
As you got into high school, college, what were you reading? And what kind of made you decide, I guess, what were some of the eureka moments or moment where it was like, whoa, I can do what my heroes are doing. People were telling you, this is good work. This inspires me. This is a mirror for me. This is a window for me. So I guess just the reading and the writing as you get into high school and college, where that took you and how you said, whoa, this is maybe something I want to do for a living, maybe down the road?
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like my biggest influences in high school, with literature were Gabriel Garcia Marquez, really into magical realism and how sort of Baroque and flowery his writing is. Really, really big fan. And then also Faulkner. I liked Faulkner. I still say my favorite book is The Sound of the Fury. One of the hardest sort of to get through. But I feel satisfied at the end of it when you get through it. It feels like work, but in the best possible way. so I don't know if that's what that says about my personality, but I really enjoy the way he sort of makes the reader work for it and put together linkages that aren't always apparent or easy to get at first glance. So those were sort of my literary kind of inspirations. In terms of high school, I was on the paper. And so early on, I just, gravitated towards writing. I think the first moment where it felt sort of real was, my personal statement probably for college, where, I was, passing it around to my sister, to other people to look at, and people were giving me compliments on it, and it just came so naturally. At that point, I started to realize that I could write, and I realized that other people didn't enjoy it as much as I did. That was when I think I first realized that potentially I had some talent in that way. People really don't like writing, and I think it is one of those things that it's rare for someone to really enjoy the writing or even enjoy the writing process. Even now, people ask me, how can you, with a full-time day job, write? Like, how do you find the time and how do you find the motivation? And it's because it's a hobby for me. It's fun. Oh, like, that's what I do on the weekends for fun.
Right.
And so I think realizing that that was sort of odd is what made me think, okay, well, if that comes naturally to me, if that's something that's fun for me, then, you know, they always tell you, try to do what you love for work, as your job, as your career. And so I was hoping that one day down the line that would happen. And I'm glad it's finally coming true.
Huh. So cool. So you see it as a relief or a therapy or a release, like at the end of the day.
That's absolutely cool. Yeah. No, it helps me clear my mind, organize my thoughts. I get excited as much as if I were reading a book while I'm writing it. So my personal essay for college was about the sort of pain I felt, the sadness I felt when I had to kill off characters in my novels, how that made me feel sort of like my moral sensibilities were heightened or peaked when that happened. And it's because I take it personally. I really enjoy the writing the story. It's fun for me. It's a ride for me. I get excited about the prospect of turns and twists and maybe shocking people or that sort of feeling, I think, is what keeps me doing it, even if it's late night or on the weekend. Even if I'm not getting paid for it at the time, it still motivates me.
Oh, that's cool. Back to Faulkner, I'll give you major props. Can you pronounce the name of the county that he creates?
Oh no, I don't know. Okay. I don't recall anymore.
He really does create his own world, right?
Right.
Yeah. We read that senior year in high school, and our professor, I mean, absolute, you know, beautiful human being and great teacher, but you know, we're just breaking our heads against it, right? And he goes at the end, he goes, well, you know, it's really, Faulkner said it was really just about a little girl who fell and like ripped her skirt or something like that, or got her skirt dirty. It's like, no, what? No.
Right.
Was that simple, really? Were you more into Marquez's, like, his stories or his books or all the above?
Yeah, so my favorite is Chronicle of a Death Foretold, Crónica de una Muerte Anunciada. I just really, it was very journalistic the way it was written. And at the time, obviously, I was interested in journalism, doing it for school. And then I also thought that would maybe be a career for me after college. And so I really liked that way he told it. 100 Years of Solitude, obviously I'm a big fan. Sort of love the sort of family saga. I loved how long and sort of involved it was. So yeah, no, his works have always been an inspiration to me.
Oh, very cool. Something I was reading in one of the interviews, I think one of or multiple birthday parties were like, you invited people to like make a story or something. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So as a kid, I would write scripts, screenplays, I guess, usually horror is what they were. And then I would force my friends at my birthday parties to act them out and we'd record them. So I did that for a couple of years as a teenager. I think they enjoyed it, but it was mostly for me, I think. My good friend growing up in high school, I would write chapters of stories for her and send them to her every week. And she was sort of my first, I guess, beta reader. Mm-hmm. And it was about my group of friends. So the characters were ourselves.
Okay.
And again, it was just a way to kind of create situations, new situations in a world, a sort of different dimension with the same people, but completely different things happening in their lives. And so the joy, sort of excitement, she was like, she would tear through it, the chapter. She was always looking forward to it. That sort of feeling was, I guess, what made me realize this is something that I wanted to do on a grander scale. And so, yeah, I've always kind of involved my friends in my writing process.
It's almost like fan fiction about yourself.
Yeah, it was. It's a little odd, but it was a fun time.
So I'd love to know, like, you know, how you got, like, the first jobs you got into. I mean, did you go to law school right away? And then, you know, how you've balanced writing and the different positions you've held.
So right out of school, college, I moved down to DC, and I was there for 4 years, working on the Hill for first Charlie Rangel from New York, and then Amy Klobuchar. Yeah, he's great. He was he is a wonderful man. And it was, I'm very grateful to him for giving my first shot, 21-year-old kid right out of school. And so that was an amazing opportunity and experience. And then I moved over to the Senate side, and I worked for Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota. And during that time, you know, I wasn't quite sure if I was going to go to law school. My sister is a lawyer. She went to law school, and she was at that time had already graduated. And so I was sort of seeing her. She, you know, she went into big law, they call it, you know, really long hours, good compensation, but you're overworked. And I saw that, and I knew that that wasn't what I wanted. I knew it wasn't likely going to go down the private firm route, and that if I did become a lawyer, it would be in the same industry business that I was doing on the Hill, which is government work, public interest, you know, serving my community, that sort of thing. And I did realize while I was on the Hill that while I do think government is a good, is a force for good, can do a lot of good in people's lives, that it was very slow moving. At the time, it was Obamacare that was being debated and thankfully all ultimately passed, but it took you know, over a year, a lot of time to have that signature piece of legislation come to fruition, come to law. And then it sort of had used up a lot of the administration's political capital, and so really administrations get one big thing they get to do, and that's it. And while I do think it was quite a beneficial piece of legislation, I kind of also wanted to feel more the fruits of my labor in real time. So a day-to-day sort of satisfaction as opposed to sort of slow moving and being one piece and a huge cog. I kind of wanted to interact myself and help people on a person-to-person level. So that's why I decided to go to law school. And while I was in law school, I was the president of Harvard Defenders, which is an indigent defense organization there. Because I think as a progressive person, I was more naturally inclined to do defense work. But it was through those 3 years where I realized and learned about how our system, so much of the power is held in the prosecutor's hands. And too many people who, you know, are sort of, they self-select, right? There are certain types who go do defense work, and there are certain types that go do prosecution. And I felt like having my outlook, my perspective on the prosecution side might do might be better for the system, and on the margins might be better, helpful. I believe in the criminal justice system. I want it also to reflect the diversity of the community it serves. And so that was why I decided to become a prosecutor after law school. And throughout it, you know, I kept writing. Again, it's just, it wasn't really with any thought necessarily of turning it into a career. I just always did it on the side. And so those years being a prosecutor, I thought, well, you know, this is, I have a story to tell about this. And so that's where the idea for this book came about.
Wow. How long ago did you start the book, or is that impossible to say because it was just bits and pieces over the years?
No, yeah, I started, I believe it was 2017, because I had written something about my mother. It's sort of magical realist. And I finished that, I remember, in 2016. So I know that my next sort of project was this book. And, you know, I little by little, I wrote it. And really during the pandemic, so 2020, the first month, the court system shut down. I was pretty much, I was working. We had arraignments virtually, but that took, for those first 3 months, it took maybe like 10 to 15 minutes in the morning. And otherwise, there wasn't a lot of work to do. So it gave me an opportunity to just finish the book. And I did within a month of the pandemic. So 2020. So about 3 years it took, little by little.
Wow. Well, thanks for a short title. I love long titles too, but man, it seems like in recent years, they're just, you know, semicolon, you know, or
right,
colon, you know, colon this, and like so many subtitles. And like, man, I wonder if you can maybe give like an elevator pitch or like a summary of the book.
Sure. I think it's hard, but
if it's too hard, we can talk through it, but you know.
No, I'll try. So I think ultimately the point of the book, the theme of the book, is the most important actor in the criminal justice system is the jury. And I think they get short shrift in literature, in multimedia. I think, you know, we focus a lot on a defense attorney or a prosecutor, potentially a judge, certainly maybe the defendant and the victim. Mm-hmm. But it matters who the jury is. But like I said, they're usually nameless. They're usually faceless. We don't get to know a lot about them. But that is all that matters, I've learned, as a prosecutor. All that matters really is who these people are, where they come from, how they're viewing the facts, through which lenses, because that ultimately dictates the verdict, more so than the actual facts. It's hard to really believe that there is such a thing as an objective fact when people put their own spin on things. I like to always use example of the Rodney King beatings, right? That was on tape, and yet people will look at the same footage and see different things. And so it matters who's the one seeing it and who's the one making the decision. And so I think that's the point of the book, that it is about looking into jurors, their past, seeing how that influences their positions, the verdict. And it's a, you know, about a case where, you know, a tough case for a prosecutor, a circumstantial case for a prosecutor, one in which, you know, no body was found, no weapon was found, and there are no real direct eyewitnesses to the murder itself. And so it's about these two very strong personalities, defense attorney and the prosecutor, battling it out in the courtroom. And then the jurors and how they're receiving that information. So that's how I would characterize the book.
Nicely done. You've done this before, I can tell. The title significance, I guess you kind of talked about it a little bit, the idea of with prejudice. We often think about it the other way around, right? The jury that everyone is supposed to deal or supposed to act without prejudice. Is that, you found it over years, that's just not possible? That's just against human nature?
You know, I think the juries try the best they can, and I do appreciate the system for trying to find the most impartial people that you can. I think the issue is that people are necessarily going to have biases, and they're going to even subconsciously see the facts through lenses which are tainted, are biased, are prejudiced in some way. Mm-hmm. And so I think, yes, that's the sort of point of the title. You know, there obviously is the legal term with prejudice. It means when things are final. For me, the interesting part of the jury is they can arrive at their decision, as long as it's an acquittal, really any way they so choose. You know, you can't arrive at a guilty verdict through improper means. That is overturnable. But if you want to completely throw out the law, you know, and it's called jury nullification, and as prosecutors, you deal with it all the time. You got to try to make the jury care about a guilty verdict, or feel so, you know, constrained by the law that even if they want to nullify, they realize they shouldn't, they can't, because the law tells them not to. You have to sort of on the front end try to convince them of that. But on the back end, there's no one there in that room to tell them how they're supposed to decide. They have the jury instructions, but they're human beings. Sure. They can arrive sort of at that decision because it's final. Not guilty is done with prejudice. There is no overturning it. There's no changing it. Once it's in the books, for whatever reason, it's done. And because of double jeopardy, the person can never be tried for that crime again. And so there's both that legal meaning, but then of course, the idea that, yeah, we all have prejudices, good ones, bad ones, that things that are just shaped the way we are. The title is not necessarily meant to be a negative connotation. We all have experiences, and actually that's part of the law too. We say, use your past experiences, use your common sense, you know, if you know how long it takes to cross the street, so on and so forth. Like you can build that into your thought process. You don't have to leave your common sense at the door. We like to say you're still a human being. Sure. But I do think we try to pretend that it, you know, it's objective. It's straight facts. When, you know, different juries definitely come to different conclusions with the same facts. And a lot of us trial lawyers, you know, once we pick a jury, we can feel it. I've known, you know, after picking a jury, this is likely going to be a guilty verdict. I just felt it by the type of personalities who were on the jury. And I've had very, very strong cases that it's really unlikely to believe that anything but what we're telling them happened. It's very strong case, very much, you know, confessions, video, DNA, that sort of thing. and people leave with a not guilty. And it happens. And you don't quite know why, but it's a matter sometimes of who they are, what, you know, what they've experienced as to why they arrive at their verdicts. Hmm.
Probably too strong to say it's arbitrary, but talking about the, you know, the fairly arbitrary nature, you know, like you said, it's all relative. It all depends on who's on the jury, who makes up the jury, their experiences. Has that shaken your faith in the justice system, or is something that you just understand as kind of just the way it is and you need to work within those constraints or those, I don't know if constraints is even the word.
Yeah, no, I mean, at least my objective with the book was not necessarily to be critical. It was more to just unveil, you know, I think first people need to know you know, what it is before it can be improved upon. And I do think, of course, the criminal justice system, you know, needs to be improved. I do think there are problems with it that need fixing. I do think, you know, there are certain communities that are disproportionately affected, punishments that are doled out that, again, can be more severe depending on who the defendant is, or actually who the victim is. An interesting fact that I grew up hearing, or I've learned through my studies, is that people used to think that the race of the defendant mattered quite a bit in terms of who was being given the death penalty and who was not. And actually, they found that the more interesting variable, or the more controlling variable, was the race of the victim. People valued the loss of white lives more, regardless of the race of the defendant. Could be a white defendant, but the white victim is what sort of made the imposition of the death penalty more likely versus a black victim. Again, not relative to the race of the defendant, because there was a less of a value on black lives. So no, there are a lot of issues, or a lot of problems, but I don't know that my faith has been shaken. I do believe in the criminal justice system. Ultimately, I don't think I could have become a prosecutor if I thought the whole system was a farce that needed to be burned down. I believe in changing it from the inside. I believe in improving upon it. And I do think it's difficult. There's a lot of good stuff about having a jury of your fellow peers, of human beings. You know, it's very almost democratic. It's very egalitarian. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, also our juries are not very diverse, because there are certain viewpoints. You know, a lot of African Americans are against the death penalty. So what ends up happening is, if you're death qualifying a jury, you're going to kick off a lot of black jurors. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's problematic, because those jurors also sit in judgment for the guilt phase as well as the sentencing phase. And so you're going to get a lot less diverse jury on capital cases, in which a lot of the defendants are disproportionately black. So there are issues. There are ways, I think, that we can improve it upon it. But I wanted to kind of show people what it's like, and how much it's dictated by human flaws, human beings. You know, we can't always control what our feelings are and our subconscious biases. And so there's a conversation to be had, whether we do want, you know, the alternative is maybe judges, you know, imposing guilt or innocence. But again, that's very elitist. These are very highly educated. They come from a certain background, whereas jurors are from everywhere. And I actually really enjoyed that prospect, that idea of meeting the jurors where they are. You know, a lot of my colleagues sometimes would get frustrated or upset at a not guilty and say, oh, well, they're, you know, speak disparaging about the jury. They didn't get it. They're dumb, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. I never felt that way, because my job was to meet them wherever they are. It was a failing. If I didn't get the not guilty, I was the one who didn't communicate, articulate well enough, convince them, persuade them enough. You know, it wasn't a failing of theirs necessarily. But that's what you get. That's what you get, a system that's, you know, jurors are making the decision, human beings are making the decision. It's going to be necessarily flawed.
Right. One of the things that makes this book so great, and I mean, first of all, just kind of backing up, I mean, congratulations. Like, you know, you talked about it. It's out there. It's coming out in a couple of days, and what a read. What an incredible read. And one of the things that makes it so great, I think, is that you don't deal in absolutes. You know, it's not, this is evil, this is purity, this, you know, it's not. I mean, it's realistic to our world. And so you set up Sandy as the prosecutor, right? As the lead prosecutor. And she, I would think would, I mean, she would dub herself to be progressive for sure, but she's also very honest, or I don't know, upfront or blunt about, you know, kind of taking advantage of some of the things like you talked about, right? Like ways to get rid of certain people on the jury or have them on the jury, or, and then, you know, without giving away the ending, and I'm going to tiptoe through that very much, because the ending is, you know, a lot of cool twists and whoa and all that. But you do end with her, and I'm not giving away anything here necessarily, but just kind of like grappling with that as she does throughout the book. But at the same time, right, you set her up that she's a woman in a mostly male dominated, you know, profession. And so she moves quickly. She's been taught by her dad, who was a, you know, a legendary one himself in the profession. I wonder about the character of Sandy. You really create some very memorable characters. I wonder where she came from.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's archetype of someone I've seen in the legal profession, that is unfortunately male dominated. And, you know, I've had the pleasure of working having supervisors of very strong women attorneys. And that's sort of my nod to them. I thought she's, you know, just a very powerful woman who is ambitious and, you know, sort of type A. You know, I, again, also at Harvard, I came across a lot of this this character, this type of person. And I thought that was good. You know, I think she's very sharp. I think shrewd. And so I do think that the system is a game a little bit. Cherry picking is definitely a game. Mm-hmm. You have to be strategic about it. They're human beings, but you're sort of judging them in, thankfully in Florida, we have quite a long time with voir dire. You basically get to spend 3 or 4 hours with the jury. I appreciate that. There are, you know, I did a trial in Massachusetts. My first one when I was at a DA's office there, my 3L year, in which there's like a jury questionnaire and there is no voir dire. So you're just kind of looking at people. And I think those are the most dangerous systems, because that's where I think there's a lot of prejudice that can come in, because you're summing up people by the way they look. And that, of course, is, you know, it sort of alludes to it. It's called the Batson Challenge in the book, about, you know, you're not obviously not supposed to strike people based on race or gender. But you are still summing up people. You're still trying to basically decide what type of person they are. And, you know, as a progressive prosecutor, it's sometimes you're looking for people who wouldn't naturally agree with you out. You know, they're probably not going to vote the same way that you are. It depends, you know, if the crime is one that, you know, us progressives tend to think are sort of under-enforced. So, you know, maybe certainly sexual assault or crimes against women, domestic violence, that sort of thing, then you might want a more a liberal jury. But judges tend to be more judgmental. They tend to respect authority. And of course, as a prosecutor, you're representing the state of Florida, you're representing authority, you're representing law enforcement in a certain capacity. And so, you're sort of at odds. You're sort of there's a conflict there, I think Sandy goes through that, right? There's you know, the defense attorney sort of calls her out. You know, you think you're this progressive person, but here you are working, you know, day and night to put this person in a cage. She says, right, to imprison this person, and it's something that I face as a prosecutor. It's difficult. It's conflicting to both be a part of the system. But know that the system needs to be improved. And so you try to do your best. You try to seek out justice, you know, dismiss cases when you feel there's something not right, when you can't prove something. Mm-hmm. But try your best and really try to hold people accountable and responsible when their crimes are particularly heinous, and when there are victims' families who are looking for closure or their, at least their story, their loved one's story to be told. Mm-hmm. I think Sandy's a reflection of that.
And then on the other side, you have Jordan and his apprentice, if you will, his helper. I want to say Sophia,
I think is her name.
Sophia, thank you. And both of them, there were a couple of, like, you know, CrossFit jokes in there. Like, you know, they both came from CrossFit. And Jordan's an interesting dude, and you know, very calculating, not necessarily in the negative sense, but I was so interested in him, of course, but also the way that he and Sandy got along or didn't. And I've always been so interested in that, this idea that like you can go at it in the courtroom, right? I mean, you can, you know, judge, you know, strike that. That's horrific. You know, how could she be saying this? How could he be saying this? And then, you know, afterwards you're like, oh, hey, good job on that. Or I just wonder what you experience with like collegiality or lack thereof between, you know, a prosecutor and the defense attorney.
Sure. It's an adversarial system. And that was something that I didn't take to too much because you're arguing, you're it's combative at times. And, you know, I did my best not to take it personally, but I, you know, you're dealing with personalities who very much may take it personally, and especially, and then so much of politics is ingrained in it. So defense attorneys will sort of appeal to you and your politics and your sensibilities. And you sort of sometimes feel like you're being called out personally because you're not, you know, dismissing this case or giving their client the deal that you don't think is that merits, that is commensurate with the crime that they've committed. So it can be really draining. It can be really emotionally taxing. I've dealt with my unfortunately fair share of really, you know, bully defense attorneys who have like physically been threatening in the courtroom, who demean me in on the record. You know, and that wasn't pleasant. But I am grateful for those defense attorneys who realized it was a job, that it was we were meant to be professional, and were able to see a distinction between what we did in the courtroom and what we do outside of it, in terms of just, you know, talking with one another and, you know, realizing that we both had a job to do, and we were both trying to end up at justice. But they have a very different objective. They have a very different, they have very different interests. Their interest is, it should be, to get the very best outcome for their client, regardless of whether he or she did it, regardless of whether it's what's best for the community, regardless if they themselves feel this person has a high risk of doing the exact same thing, hurting children, hurting the elderly, whatever it is, the crime that they are accused of committing. And that can be difficult. So that there's also that sort of conflict that I think Jordan undergoes, or you see some of that by the end. But sometimes, again, it can be very personal. It can be very emotional. It can be very dramatic. And so I think I like to say I'm a recovering homicide prosecutor. And I think it's because I needed some time away from that sort of adversarial, conflict-ridden, everyday sort of, yeah, battling.
Right. You do such a great job with, you know, balancing legalese and, you know, so you don't have to be a lawyer necessarily to understand what's going on. I wonder how you work with dialogue, which again, the dialogue is snappy. I kind of stopped a few times. I was like, whoa, you know, this has been a whole, you know, page and a half or two pages of just boom, 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 boom. You know, none of like, no, like, you know, she said, he said, because it, you know, often it's usually on the stand. But the dialogue to me seems so realistic and snappy and, you know, clever and funny, but not like overly so. How did you deal with like the dialogue, and also, which I guess is related to the jargon or the legalese, and keeping that, you know, for those, the secular ones, if you will.
Yeah. Well, no, thank you for the compliments. Yeah. I've written out a lot of directs and crosses before. So I think I kind of have that experience. I have that. So I was able to translate that into the narrative, the sort of back and forth, the sort of sharp crossing of someone. It gets, I think there's a rhythm to it. It's a little bit of an excitement. It sort of picks up your adrenaline. Crossing someone is fun, actually. again, it's a little adversarial, you know, because obviously by nature it's crossing. You're sort of trying to reveal the person on the stand to be either a liar or a, you know, exaggerator, that sort of thing. But there's a rhythm and a that I wanted to have reflected in the book, and so I'm glad that came across. Legalese. You want to be realistic, right? You don't want lawyers to read it and think, because I've been annoyed myself watching or reading, you know, things in the courtroom and saying, that's why is that person talking? That's they're having this soliloquy in the middle of the courtroom. That doesn't happen. The judge should be shutting that down. I wanted it to be realistic and legal and truthful to my experience, but also obviously not have non-lawyers sort of glaze over, because that can be boring, but a lot of the lies is dramatic, especially criminal law. Mm-hmm. It was very, very fun. And even the sort of the strategy, the legal sort of maneuvering, that's a lot of fun to me. So I hope I was able to straddle that line so that it wasn't too in the weeds. Yeah. But maybe people learned and picked up a couple of things about the law that they didn't know, the inside baseball, you know?
Yes. You talk about watching things and saying, this isn't realistic. That wouldn't happen. Are there TV shows, Law and Order? Are there movies, are there, you know, books that you really feel like did get it right? Or did, like, you don't have to say that didn't, but do you feel like, man, I got it right?
Oh yeah. You know, I have a couple of, you know, I think Defending Jacob was one that I watched that I didn't read first, but I watched it.
Okay.
And I thought it did a good job. I thought that was pretty realistic. Mm-hmm. There was an HBO one that I didn't find too realistic, but I can't recall the name, so that's probably for better.
Right.
And, you know, like, I think there is such a thing as artistic licenses. I'm not, like, sure, super critical to the point. You know, we use Law and Order in our jury picking all the time, I think, because we're worried that, or CSI mostly, we're worried people are going to think, you know, that our technology has advanced to the point that if you're not bringing in, you know, this high tech, you know, DNA on everything, sort of, you know, the killer was captured in the eye
glass or something.
Yeah, something high tech and ridiculous. You know, that they're gonna say the state didn't bring enough evidence. Whereas I like to remind them, you know, how did people convict 200 years ago? There was no DNA, there's no cameras, it's citizens, you know, people, witnesses saw things, and you decide is that person credible, or are they telling the truth, do they have a motivation to lie. It's funny how much jurors think there's all this motivation for witnesses to go through 2 or 3 years of depositions. In Florida we have depositions for every single witness, so they've already told their story multiple times, they're being subpoenaed, they're taking days off of work, they're sitting up there and being crossed by an attorney who's calling them a liar. None of it is a pleasant experience, and they think, oh, they just got up there for fun, they're lying for no good reason. Obviously, sometimes there are witnesses who are biased, who have motivations to lie. They're either benefiting some way, profiting in some way. But a lot of people are just good Samaritans. It's funny how skeptical, I guess, human nature is. But
such an interesting thing where you start off in past tense, and then we go into present tense. There's a lot of flashbacks and flash forwards, and just the way that you deal with the backstories of the jurors, of those prosecuting, is just so interesting. And, like, man, and the way, you know, that you bring up certain stories at certain times, certain memories at certain times. I wonder how you, like, kind of the mechanics of writing this, where did you write it in the same order as it appears in the book, or was it like, you know, one thread, boom, 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 done, and then kind of intermix? How did that work?
Yeah, well, and you know, the choice of when it's past tense and present tense is very intentional. You know, it, sort of the ending, it's supposed to sort of fit with the ending of the book.
Sure.
But in terms of writing it, I wrote it the way it appears, which. I think people think it's odd, or at least they wouldn't have expected it. They would expect that sort of, with a story that's a little bit patchwork, where there is sort of different threads, hopefully coming together nicely at the end.
Oh yeah.
That it might be sort of better to sort of conceptually to sort of separate them and write them out differently. But I didn't. And I think because I want to be true to, I want to go on the journey along with the reader and make sure that I'm being honest, so that when there are, you know, twists or so on and so forth, that they feel earned, they're not cheap, and that there isn't either, you know, I throw in a little bit of their Easter eggs, I think, on a reread, as to so the ultimate ending. But I think I think going along with it makes it so that I can realize, you know, what is it the reader needs to know at this point, what is it that there would be interesting for them to know, as opposed to, so that it threads together, as opposed to sort of seeing them as separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like, the very beginning, for example, you have Earl Thomas, who is kind of very awkwardly named the Jerry Foreman with, you know, he calls it a microaggression. It's racist. It's patronizing. And you juxtapose that with him being pulled over and harassed, over his beloved car. Right. So that's one of the first like stories that really pulls you in, one of the first backstories. And we get it, you know, we get it from Sandy a bit. We get it from, Sterling. Is it Sam Sterling?
Sam Sterling, yep.
Right? I mean, he has a pretty incredible and sad, background and story. You get a little bit out with Lee, you know, who's the guy who's, opening his day at the bar, not ending it, right? That kind of thing.
Right.
You know, those are just some of the stories. Dr. Laura Hurtado, and there's so many interesting stories that go throughout. I wonder about... So, you know, the main part here is that we have Gabriel Soto, who we don't actually know a lot about, right? Even, you know, at the end, towards the end, we get some more about him, but we really don't know a whole lot about him. He is the one who's on trial, right? There was even one point where you wrote it very well, something about how the people in the courtroom even forgot he was there, right? Because of, like, you talk about the storytellers who are the lawyers, the jury, you know, all those, the judge and the motions and this and that. It's like, oh yeah, he's there too. And then, she goes by Mel, is it Melina?
Yep.
Melina Mora, right? Who's a very, you know, who's a sympathetic character in many ways. And she is the one who was killed. We of course feel so much for her family, for her mom. I wonder how much of her, because she was, you know, pretty much everyone admitted she was a carefree, happy, for the most part, you know, trusting person who, you know, had her flings, which of course, you know, there are things like the rape shield, and there are things like, obviously there's an incredible double standard where, you know, a guy is celebrated and congratulated while she's, you know, the name could possibly be put through the mud. I wonder about Melina as a character, or just, I guess, as an archetype, kind of where that came from, this idea that young, beautiful, smart, but also where, you know, they didn't want to attack the character, or they did, you know, kind of where that came into play.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think to your earlier point, the victim and the defendant sort of become wallpaper. It's kind of unfortunate, certainly for both. Obviously, the man, in this case, it's a man, the man who's being accused and whose, you know, liberty is at stake. This is all for him. This is the whole show is we're here because of him, and that he's going to face the consequences. And yet it sort of feels like a show, and it feels like he's not really a main character because he isn't speaking usually, very often doesn't testify. The defendant usually invokes their right to silence against self-incrimination. And so as a prosecutor, sometimes you need to remind people. You need to remind people, like, I need you to remember the bad thing he did, because we're sort of, you know, talking about the law, talking about it becomes a game, who's sure. Winning what objections. Oh, the judge is really sustaining that person's objections, this, that, and the other, where it's really should be about this, you know, society healing from, you know, the process, I think, of the trial is more important than really the results. It's about having this moment where we're getting the truth out, where we're deciding what happened, and we're saying, okay, that was wrong. I think there's an expressive function to the law that's really important that sometimes gets lost in the gamemanship a little bit. Same thing with the victim, you know, and that's more by design. You're not supposed to get up there and try to evoke so much sympathy for her. You can't really talk too much about what, you know, she's done in her past, you know, and good things, you know, trying to, you know, paint a portrait of her and what was lost to the family, because that might be prejudicial. You know, it's supposed to be about the facts, not necessarily about how good of a person she was or how much of a loss it meant to the family. Like, that's not supposed to be the reason you convict somebody. So she also kind of fades into the background, and unfortunately, you know, we forget the victim who was treated that way. So Melina, for me, just came from having that experience, particularly, you know, when I was the last 3 years in which I was the homicide prosecutor, the sort of pain that the family feels and how little they hear about their person that they're there trying to vindicate throughout the trial. And so I wanted, you know, I've had that sort of victim before, young, you know, one of my most serious cases was a young woman who was brutally raped and then beaten to death by a young man. And I think I thought of her a lot while writing this because I, you know, I wanted certainly to show that, you know, a sympathetic victim, really, I think we should be sympathetic to anybody who loses their life. And I think that's what was concerning to me sometimes as a prosecutor, is that sometimes you do have victims who aren't, they were either angry or, you know, maybe didn't have the best reputation, maybe weren't, you know, of the socioeconomic status of a lot of the members of the jury, whatever it is, you still want people to realize that no one is deserving of death. But yeah, I wanted to showcase that often defense attorneys, I think because a lot of what I read lionizes defense attorneys, and I think their job is incredible. It's a noble profession. And as I said, I more naturally was inclined to do defense work before I decided to become a prosecutor. But I do think that there's conflict there. Sometimes you have to beat up on a dead victim. Sometimes you have to call them names in the courtroom. In essence, you have to stress the parts of them that maybe, again, go against your sensibilities. Maybe you think is kind of horrific to do, but that's in the best interest of your client. And so I wanted to show that. I wanted to show that there are sort of, just as there are seedy, sort of maybe unpleasant parts of being a prosecutor, it's the same on the defense side. Really, in the criminal justice system, unfortunately, nobody really has clean hands, really. It's a little bit of a tragic sort of all around. Everybody's sort of dealing in tragedy, basically. So I wanted to, through the victim, show that some of the tactics of the defense can be sort of morally repugnant. And we're all trying to reach this ultimate good, this ultimate truth, but there's a lot of ugliness in the criminal justice system.
Yeah, again, what you do so well in the book is you don't just give a voice, you give so many voices, right? You give voices to people, you give their background, you know, which helps us to know their motivations. And, you know, there's something about, you give one and a half, two flashbacks of Melina, one not long before she was killed, and then one, you know, maybe I guess 10 years earlier, but, you know, to know her, to see her dialogue is that, you know, she's not just a nameless, faceless victim. She was, you know, she's a full-fledged human being. So that was, seems obvious, but extremely well done. And again, man, you know, don't want to give away too much of the ending or the book as a whole, but just so many interesting characters, the twists and turns, the drama is clearly there. The ending, you know, you may think it's an ending and it's not quite the ending, just keeps you going. And at the end, you're just like, wow, this is a writer who has really captured something, has really captured the zeitgeist. So a huge congratulations to you on this one.
Thank you so much. I appreciate all the kind words. I'm glad you, that's what I was trying to do. So I'm glad you picked up on it.
You know, and I'm just a dude in my little, you know, bedroom/office here saying this. You've gotten some great blurbs from, help me with the pronunciation. Is it Harlan Coben?
Harlan Coben and Scott Turow.
Yeah. You know, someone like me who doesn't necessarily read in that genre all the time, but I mean, I for sure as a layman know those names. With publishing, I know that genre does matter or can matter. Is this going to be marketed as a thriller, as a legal thriller? How does that work?
Yeah, all of the above. I like to think that, you know, it's also a little bit of literary fiction. It's kind of like a mix, because I do think hopefully it makes you think. And it is, there's a lot of, it's character driven. I think there's a plot, certainly. And so I think I tried to balance those two so that we sort of get a nice picture of people and atmospherics while also moving forward the plot. It's, you know, legal thriller, a thriller, all of the above.
Is there a sequel in the works? Or I'd love to know. I know you're like, oh man, I'm just getting this dang book out. But I'd love to know, just not necessarily about sequel, but any future projects you're working on.
Yeah, so I'm interested in sort of picking up a character and sort of having a different story, so it wouldn't be a sequel, but someone from this book that's sort of familiar as maybe even a minor character in the second one. I'm working now on sort of like a political thriller set in DC on the Hill, given my experience there. So I'm excited about that potentially. I just want to keep writing things I think that are hopefully thrilling, exciting, dramatic, but also look at our society, you know, whether it's race, gender, all the sorts of complex, you know, debates and cultural issues that we face, and really says something about them, really reveals something about them, because, you know, they're obviously foremost on the minds of people. On my mind, having, you know, lived as a, you know, minority in America, I think that they're important issues to talk about. I think most interesting to me is how white people view race. I think that often when we're talking about race, we'll talk about the perspective from the person facing either the microaggression or the minority. But I think there's so much interest in seeing how the dominant group, how they respond to race, how they respond to their own race, because whiteness is a race. And so sometimes we see it as the default, and race is only sort of in opposition to whiteness. But I think that they're, you know, both merit study. And so I think those sorts of issues are ones that are always kind of foremost in my mind, and hopefully will be reflected in my writing. But I also, again, want to make sure it's entertaining, want to make sure it's fun, want to make sure people both think, but then feel a sense of satisfaction. So that's what I'm hoping to write next.
Yeah. So many believable characters, so many interesting characters. I could see a book for, you know, character A, character B. Run me the name of the one who kind of like became like a self-styled like vigilante on the jury.
Oh yes. Joseph Cole.
Yes. I mean, I was laughing, but also cringing, and also just, you know, I mean, he was just from a writing point of view, did a great job with the character. Even his wife was like, oh God, you know, with this guy. But he was also, I mean, he's also reminded me of like a George Zimmerman or something, right?
Right.
Where it's just like, okay, this is, you know, these microaggressions, if you will, become full-fledged racist, you know, violent, you know, the whole deal. So there were some characters that were, so many characters in here just like, wow, did a great job really shaping them. Again, I want to thank you, and man, have fun with all the promotions and all the stuff as you get into it this week. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'll try my best to not be too nervous and to enjoy it all.
Pleasure talking to you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
What a pleasure it's been to speak today to Robin Peguero. Continue good luck to him with his writing. So looking forward to following his career. You can now subscribe to the Chills of Will podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also ask for it by name using Alexa, find it on Stitcher, and on any of your favorite streaming platforms. Follow me on Instagram, where I'm at Chills at Will Podcast, or on Twitter, where I'm at Chills at Will PO1. And pardon me, Robin, please, your social media.
Oh, I think my Instagram is Sir Robin of Luxley. My Twitter should be my last name, Pigetto Robin.
Okay, cool. Any like favorite bookstores? You mentioned one earlier. Any favorite bookstores where, you know, go out and support?
Oh yeah, Books and Books. You know, like I said, I used to go there all the time, and I'll be appearing there on Friday. So that's always a favorite of mine, a local Coral Gables, Miami establishment.
Okay. Awesome. The People's Republic of Miami, as it's referred to in the book.
That's right. That's right.
I love that. You can watch this and other episodes on YouTube. Watch and subscribe to Chills at Will podcast channel. Please tune in for episode 125 with Jamil John Kochai, the author of 99 Nights in Logar, which is through Viking, which is a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award for debut novel and the DSC Prize for South Asian Literature. He was born in an Afghan refugee camp in Peshawar, Pakistan, but he originally hails from Logar, Afghanistan. His short stories and essays have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Plowshares, and the O. Henry Prize Stories 2018. Currently, he's a Stegner Fellow at Stanford University. And he's also, I guess, a fellow Sacramentan, so we'll look forward to talking about that. The episode will air on May 31st. For now, thanks again for listening, and I hope that these quarantine days bring you texts by writers with mad skills, like Robin Peguero, whose work, like With Prejudice, gives you chills at will.
Thank you.